My name is Michael McCusker. Today is the 70th anniversary of the start of the Korean War, June 25th, 1950. The newly established communist regime of North Korea attacked across the 38th parallel that bifurcated the Korean people and nearly destroyed the non-communist South. A quick synopsis of the subsequent internecine conflict is that the Cold War between Russian communism and Western democracy had its first outbreak when the two halves of the ideologically divided Korean Peninsula went to war against each other as puppets of larger forces. The war was a seesaw conflict when it wasn't a stalemate, and it lasted three very bloody years. Newly communist China got into it when the Western armies and South Korean ROKs chased the invading North Koreans back across the 38th dividing parallel to the Chinese border. The Chinese, having just won a 30-year revolution, crossed en masse the Yellow River and repulsed the Allies back across the parallel. And there the war stagnated into a World War I-type stalemate until a truce 3 years later. Several millions died. Most of them, of course, the ordinary people, who Mao Zedong, at the time China's new Red Star boss, famously said were the sea warring despots, soldiers, and revolutionaries swam in. And North Korea was bombed nearly back to the Stone Age, for which it has never forgiven the USA. American Korean War veterans, for their part, have been as neglected as much as the war has been forgotten, as though it never occurred. It might all be revived more terribly than before. U.S. President Trump, in his usual deflection of responsibility, blames China for the coronavirus pandemic, Kung Flu, he calls it. And relations between Fat Man Trump and Little Boy, his North Korean counterpart, each the name of the first atomic bombs, are once again increasingly nuclear. Ambrose Bierce, whose 178th birthday was yesterday, defined war in his infamous Devil's Dictionary. A byproduct of the art of peace, the most menacing political condition is a period of national amity. War likes to come like a thief in the night. Professions of eternal amity provide the night. And that was Ambrose Bierce. And now something I wrote on more or less the same topic, our hair trigger world. Late spring or early summer, when the ground is dry and hard, is traditionally the season when winter restless armies clash. It is almost a contradiction. When life is renewed, armies sharpen their spears, load their cannon, gas up their tanks and bombers, aim their rockets and ICBMs. Yet human males, the killer gender of Homo sapiens, are especially ardent for war because they are unable to give birth, the intrinsic winter of their discontent, perhaps. There is no good war and no bad peace, Benjamin Franklin has been endlessly quoted as saying. But peace has been defined also as a period between wars, a time to bury the dead, heal wounds, produce new weapons, and so newer crops of human fodder to continue the genocides of their forebears. The eternal possibility of war is an ironic symbol that humanity always threatens its future by never getting past the conflicts of its earliest credulities, which essentially originated from elemental perceptions of life and purpose, but retroceded into savage dogmas frozen like fossils in ice. War is never necessary or seldom justified, despite its persistent beckoning. And there has never been a good war, only ruthlessly reckless wars that compel a tribe, a city, a nation to defend itself from the malevolent ambitions of incessant enemies. Conversely, people will generally support a war once it is initiated, if for no other reason than they feel no alternative. In this era of a supposed common person, the focus is upon citizen combatants who are not responsible for the wars they are mobilized into fighting, but make possible. The short, grim life of soldiers, nearly all of them civilian conscripts, has never been more apparent than during the wretched stalemate of trench warfare in Western Europe a century ago during World War I. Artillery and airplanes were unable to kill at long range, as they later were, which compelled soldiers to be the major targets. The shells and bombs that fell among them like rain for 4 years made mockeries of courage, fear, and sacrifice. The poor unknowns, whom the barrages missed, machine guns mowed down like threshed grain. A distinction between just wars and unjust wars, a distinction made in medieval times by the Christian Church to justify its religious wars, is equally or more important to a war's conduct as it is its reason or rationalization for being implemented. The main distinction is the prohibition of intentionally targeting civilian populations in a war to be considered a just war, nor should disproportionate force be used. But as the wholesale bombings by both sides in World War II indicates, the differences are too often degrees of propaganda rather than reality. And more likely, the development of nuclear power for warfare obliterates even the flawed concept of so-called just wars, exactly as two atomic bombs virtually obliterated two Japanese cities and their inhabitants 75 years ago this summer. The two nuclear bombs that ended World War II might have put an end to warfare for good in a more sensible world, in addition with the advent of the United Nations to codify war's end. Instead, a nuclear arms race between two conflicting and aggressive ideologies, the USA and USSR, allies and victors against Nazism, divided and intimidated the world for half a century of what George Orwell called a Cold War. Simultaneous to developing immense nuclear arsenals, both the USA and USSR initiated or supported so-called brushfire wars all over the world, each by proxy or direct involvement. The first of these Cold War wars was that between North and South Korea, which started today, 70 years ago, when the communist North invaded the South with Russian tanks and its own army, the Imungun, on June 25, 1950. As with most other effects of insatiable technology, warfare has advanced far beyond nature's strictures of weather or geography. The world's militaries, even the poorest from the most obscure nation, are able to make war anytime or any place. So-called state-of-the-art weapons, graded by their degree of horribleness, float around the world, sold by arms merchants to anyone with money, credit, or good prospects. The industrial nations are arms bazaars, producing and marketing exotic and high-tech weapons, vicariously enamored by the increased carnage rockets and jet fighter bombers make of tribal-level squabbles. Humanity has perfected war, refined it to an instrument of digital logic that no longer depends upon human rationale or justification. No philosophy or psychology, only strategy and provocation. The invention of the harpoon gun and the exploding harpoon decimated the whale. The chainsaw has cut down the world's forests. By also inventing such weapons as the machine gun and the hydrogen bomb, we almost match our reckless destruction of the home planet by abetting our own extinction. This de facto decadence might be related to the hallucinatory dread of nuclear extermination, which has been too large a horror to bear for 75 years. It seems inconceivable that humanity has made itself capable of its own extinction, and that by our own will, or more agonizing, by the willfulness of only a few of us, we can disappear from history as absolutely as dinosaurs and dodo birds. Genesis might be a warning. Instead of a myth of divine conception, it is a prophecy of mega-death. Perhaps we are still in the Garden of Eden, which is a metaphor for life. Evil might not be sex after all, or knowledge, but humanity's careless brutality that leads irresistibly toward plucking the overripe fruit of specicide. in the USA, the world's first nuclear power, the clock is half a minute to midnight. The military-industrial nuclear mafia of colossal interlocking corporations and the Pentagon has created a black hole into which everything is drawn and disappears, such as the nation's sanity in tandem with its wealth and vital resources. And amidst the darkness, the immense fortunes bequeathed to arms manufacturers overwhelm whatever qualms for producing weapons that might render humanity extinct. Thousands of private war industries produce nuclear warfare components, the systems for transporting, arming, and launching the weapons. Hundreds of billions of the national wealth are poured into weapons systems, both nuclear and non-nuclear. Many more mega millions must be added to nuclear weapons research grants to hundreds of American universities and experimental labs. The nuclear arms mania works a double liability. It erodes what remains of our tottering constitutional democracy and holds its citizenry hostage to the fears and oppressive secrecy it invokes. And it drains boodles of billions of public tax dollars into private fortunes of munitions makers, which has probably not been much affected by the coronavirus lockdown. The rubric of national defense prioritization places the nuclear nabobs beyond public scrutiny and accountability, and their immense wealth provided by an increasingly disenfranchised citizenry gives them tremendous political power, which is likely fulgurously conservative in nature. The nonpartisan unofficial policy is probably to design and produce nuclear weapons until Armageddon. Armageddon is, of course, the place for the last battle at the end of the world, located in ancient biblical lands. Armageddon is also, like midnight on the nuclear clock of doom, the time of doomsday. Almost all earthly religions prophesize a final battle or cataclysm that will end human life, if not Earth itself. Humanity is now present at prophecy, although only a very small minority are responsible for the road taken. Yet all of human history has led us to the savage frontier of its most primitive fears. We are as much under assault by barbarity as were the civilizations of antiquity, only now from within our own advanced civilization, which acts with craven barbarousness. The military castes cast themselves as protectors of the peace, but paralyze their sensibilities to only the worldview that is the shrine of their profession, the ultimate final battle of Armageddon. We cannot uninvent nuclear technology or the earth-shattering weapons devised from it. The knowledge is with us for as long as Homo sapiens defies its own handicaps and continues to dwell in the galaxy. If we self-styled humans of wisdom are not smart enough to contain our atomic goblin, our ruined cities will eventually be mere skeletal artifacts of our foolish and ruinous existence on this third planet from the sun. And that was our Hair Trigger world. And now, something that I read on the air a few years back, and I wrote it a few years earlier. Children want peace. The word peace apparently frightens the most eminent of men, though not so much the women. It would seem if it were in the domain of peaceniks, an attitude of political style religiously avoided by so many who wish to impress a highness of purpose, particularly in partisan political life, which is in fact at least as bloodthirsty and more viciously sinister than war. This assumption can be partially gleaned through such past examples as the hot potato treatment given by the Long Beach City, California, City Council during the height of the Vietnam War. The 9 elected city officials, all men, and all who had consistently gone on record supporting nearly every proposal and movement of any war-besotted veterans group, going even so far as to add personal platitudes, whether or not they knew what they were talking about, were faced with a 10-page concept towards peace in the spring of 1969, and it utilized the innocence and joy of children. And the city councilman, like Pilate, or perhaps more like the frantic white rabbit who was in a hurry to obey his queen rather than to help Alice, washed their hands of it. I have received a communication concerning a matter that if you were to be concerned at all, and I don't know that you would, the city mayor said to the council, would involve a lot of money and a good deal of activity. This is something concerning children want peace, and I don't know what we're going to do with it. A man had envisioned a children's crusade. Not the children's crusade of the Dark Ages, when almost all the tiny crusaders were sold into slavery by other good Christians and friars long before they reached the Holy Land. Nor was it to be something in the nature of the Pied Piper, who led away the innocents from their corrupted and selfish parents, never to be seen again. The only resemblance to the latter was music, and it was to be created by children, still experiencing a stage of life and purity of intent, sorely missed by all who grow older. The guru was hardly the image of other prophets. He was Stanley Slotkin, founder of Abbey Rents, anything you can imagine, from wheelchairs to wedding caterers could be rented from Abbey Rents. Yet this man conceived of a concept that could not be appreciated enough with words. He would have children from all over the world gather annually in a single spot and sing songs of peace they have written. Slotkin's idea was to sponsor competitions, song festivals, in every country. Children would write peace songs, and each country would have a well-publicized contest. The child who wrote the best music would share top honors with the child who wrote the best lyrics. Then, for the first International Peace Song Festival, the two winning kids from each country would come to the United States, perhaps in the summer when growing things have dug their roots deep, and perform their compositions to audiences grossing perhaps 15,000 in the flesh, and who knows how many multi-billions on worldwide satellite radio and television hookups. Slotkin was a born promoter. He was indirectly responsible for promoting a hit song that was a song of peace. He wanted to see if people would sing such a song. Searching in 1956, he found one titled, Let There Be Peace on Earth and Let It Begin With Me. It had only been sung twice, apparently. Slotkin printed copies to send to every church, club, and civic organization in Los Angeles County. Soon he was printing them by the thousands and believed the song would be sung by millions all over the world. Even the Miss Universe contest used it for an opener before Trump. What was important, Slotkin realized, people will sing a song of peace. It was in that year, 1956, that he first conceived of the children music plea. He explained it in a letter he wrote to the Long Beach City Council. In 1956, I was in a small Asian country at the time England, France, and Israel attacked the Suez Canal. This Asian country had just won its independence, and their foreign department mistook this incident to be the beginning of a Third World War. Air travel was discontinued, and foreigners were given bulletins for 5 days about the events of World War III. Mention was made that Russia was mobilizing, that China was marching, and I lived the first 5 days of the next World War. Finally, flights were resumed, and when I arrived in Manila, I learned the Third World War lasted only 2 days. I had been frightened, and I asked myself, why can't we have peace in this world? If we are hungry, we eat. If we are thirsty, we drink, but humanity has wanted peace since the beginning of time, yet have never had peace. I concentrated on the meaning of the word peace. My conclusion was that an adult first not understand the meaning of the word peace, and secondly, really does not want peace. Slotkin reached those conclusions because he asked questions. Ask any adult in any country his or her definition of the word peace, Slotkin wrote, explaining he had asked that question of Europeans and Orientals, adults and children. At the end of each answer to you, the word peace becomes an economic explanation of a person's position in the community and involves the size of a man's home and number of bathrooms and the fact he needs another car because his children are growing up and the taxes are too high. When he asked children, "What is the meaning of peace?" the immediate answer was, "It means no war." And because of that answer, so simple and pure, Slotkin bet all his chips on them. He thought children, before they had the economic burdens and interests of their elders, could be taught the meaning of peace and the value of peace and the central fact that peace is, indeed, no war. His reasoning was that within 10 or 15 years, when the children grew up in their respective countries, some of them would conceivably be in a position of deciding whether to conduct peace or war in this tired, frightened old world. Hitler did such a great job with the children of Germany that they even informed on their own families who paid the penalty of death in the gas chambers sent there by their own children, Slotkin said. If Hitler can do that, then we can teach the children of the world the meaning of the word peace, the desire to have peace, and we will create an influence that in 10 or 20 years from now will bear results. To soothe and entice the financial beast, Slotkin threw out some promotional bait, listing profits of such a spectacle on the scale of the International Peace Song Festival, from ticketed seats, exclusive television rights, album and sheet music sales, even shirts and toys. For the second year, the International Festival would be held in some European capital, such as Rome or London, which Slotkin projected would be a 25% increase in income. For the third year, in the Orient this time, perhaps Hong Kong or Tokyo, Saigon was at war, and apparently no communist nations were to be involved, initially at least, Slotkin added a 25% ticket increase because of what he figured would be rising public interest. Should all the countries in the world eventually enter and wish to send their children to participate, it may be necessary to have a fourth festival somewhere in the world, said the crafty peace entrepreneur. Perhaps in countries on the other side of the Iron Curtain. He never said, but the hint was there. And he never explained why he chose Long Beach to be notified, except that he had hoped to stage the first festival somewhere in Los Angeles County. Long Beach was also a major naval port for the Vietnam War. That same year, the Long Beach City Council was petitioned to withdraw from the war, as had attempted a small Ohio town, Bealsville, which had lost 7 young men to the war, apparently most of the town's latest generation of males. President Richard Nixon had refused the request. The Long Beach City Council refused to hear it, ruling that the war was not city business, which was the fate of Slotkin's idea. Slotkin called his musical crusade, "Children Want Peace." Since all children like music, and all children seem to be creating enough attention in this world today, Slotkin wrote to the disapproving Long Beach City Council, "My plan is to give each child in the world a chance to enter the International Peace Song Festival. Let's get to these young people who are interested in music and who can communicate with music to study the meaning of the word peace. It takes study to write a song of peace. Let's hope that if and when they are in positions to make decisions, they will remember their studies and bring peace to this world eventually." None of it ever seemed to have happened. So therefore, and although children do not count in the affairs of their elders, a decade later, children all over the world were still wishing to be heard about nuclear devastation. And these are by fourth grade students at the Bush School in Seattle, Washington, 35 years ago. Their teacher, John Marsh, asked for their impressions of nuclear warfare during Nuclear Awareness Week in October. "Peace. Wouldn't it be much better if we had more? I think it would be very nice because there wouldn't be any more wars, no more people disliking each other. It would be like an out-of-tune piano if there wasn't peace, but with peace it's like a pattern of harmony and love for each other. If there was peace, it would be like a big flower garden blooming in peace and love. Peace means sharing our food and drink with the people who need it to stay alive, to love everyone good or bad, rich or poor, black or white. Peace is just something you can't say with words. It's like a feeling deep inside that you can't describe, because peace is a type of love, either because it won't really come out of your heart or because it is only your secret and your feelings that will really know what peace is. And peace is beautiful, and that is what it should be to everyone. And that was from Christy Robinson and from Jenny Westberg. I think that if we are mad at someone, we should talk to him or her about it, or someone else who has nothing to do with the fight, or whatever made you mad might get hurt. Conflict between any number of people or countries can cause fights or wars. If it is a fight, people might lose friends and get hurt. Small fights are not serious because usually it is between family members or friends, so they are easily forgotten. If it is a war, billions of people will get killed unless we can stop nuclear bombs and wars and make peace. And that was Jenny Westberg, and both of these from the Bush School during Nuclear Awareness Week, 1 October, a number of years ago, at the Bush School in Seattle, Washington. And now a poem, which I like to read mostly every summer, and it's called Summer's Children. We do not know who chose us, but we are the chosen. We were chosen not to be you. We enter your cities like fog, with our bedrolls and our portable lives, our ragged coats always too big, the better for sleeping in. We follow summer, and we all look alike to you. With our uncombed hair, we look like winter. When we are young, we look older. When we are older, we begin to look young. You do not want to look at us, and since we are invisible to you, we can urinate anywhere. We are not lost. We know where we are, but our itinerary is chance and weather. We do not believe in destinations, and we are in no hurry. We have learned patience from statues in 1,000 parks and joy from dogs without collars. We envy you nothing you want. We can live on what you throw away. We envy only birds of passage, their ability to fly. Sometimes we ask for your spare change, but never your credit cards. Otherwise, we keep our distance, avoiding the germs of your misery. The wolf does not come to our doors. We have no doors. We have lost our names somewhere and are required to sign nothing. We do not pay taxes. We feed the birds. We do not vote. Why should we vote for you? We do not join the army. We are an army, and we will not fight in your wars. We have lost our return addresses. Old forwarding addresses, our social security numbers, and are secure in our own society. We leave messages to one another on the undersides of bridges in a code you cannot decipher. But we plot to overthrow nothing. We escape. We are summer's children, born into your winter. We are not a problem. We are a solution to a problem. You are the problem. And that was Summer's Children by Richard Shelton. And this is Michael McCusker. Today is also another war anniversary. On June 25th, 1876, George Armstrong Custer, a very egotistic and extremely vain American Army officer, had planned to campaign for the 1876 presidency and thought a great Indian victory would cinch the White House for him. But he lost the Little Bighorn primary on this date. Stay safe. Protecting yourself protects everybody else. Wear masks in public for everybody's sake. The pandemic insanity caused by Trump's bilious lies and callous contempt toward the public health certainly deserves him to be hauled before the world court for coronacide.